As resistance to the war in Iraq builds here at home, we're seeing more and more soldiers in Iraq and soldiers who are destined to go to Iraq standing up and saying that they don't support this war and they won't go to this war. The latest case is Augustin Aguayo. He's a combat medic in the U.S. Army who had filed for conscientious objector status in February of 2004 before being deployed to Iraq. My understanding is that once he got there, he was still, his conscientious objector status was denied. And the reason being was that the Army told him that he didn't prove his case. So he refused to return to service and went AWOL after his first tour. But even during his first tour, he refused to put bullets in his gun. And I have to say, I was really moved by that. I think others in the Army told him, fine, if you have a suicide wish, go ahead. But he said, I won't kill. I refuse to kill. I don't believe in war.
And when he finally went what they call AWOL, absent without leave, he was actually in Germany at the time. And according to a news article, he slipped through a bathroom window to avoid going back to Iraq after losing his CO case.
His wife says something really interesting about that. And we'll play a clip for you in a little bit, her giving a speech with her account of what happened to her husband, how he was taken, why he was taken, why he resists, and how he escaped, and what's happening to him now.
I think one thing that's particularly important about his case is that you have to see it in the context of many, many more people refusing to fight in Iraq. And in Germany, apparently, according to the Financial Times, that the spirit of the people in the U.S. bases in Germany, which is the largest U.S. military permanent bases overseas, has been falling, particularly about the issue of going to Iraq. The figures are quite astounding. There's a statistic that puts at 14,000 the number of personnel who went AWOL between 2000 and 2005. And as people who've been listening to this show know, this month, the decision by 1,000 active duty soldiers and reserve soldiers and Marines that petitioned Congress for a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. And that was a guest we had on.
Yeah, Jonathan Hutto. He was one of the main organizers. And he hasn't gone AWOL. He's still actively enlisted in the military. However, they're having people who are actively enlisted saying, we don't support this war.
Now, it's interesting to go back to the cases in Germany. The Financial Times interviews a soldier who refused to continue serving. He just wouldn't reenlist. His name is Evers. And he said he had just read a book by Ludwig Beck, who was a Nazi general who resigned after the Nazis, well, it was a Wehrmacht general before the Nazis took power. And he resigned when the Nazis rose to power in Germany. He tells about why he won't go back to Iraq. And he says, quote, I would die to defend my country or the Constitution in a moment. I would even die to bring democracy to another people, he says, but I will not fight an illegal war of aggression. So you have a whole bunch of soldiers
now. That's really so hopeful.
Yeah, really,
it is
really beginning to move.
Because when this happened during Vietnam, it was the beginning of the end.
That's hopeful from, you know, an international law and humanitarian law perspective. But if you look at what the Supreme Court has said, the Supreme Court has said something clearly the opposite. In 1971, they had a decision that basically ruled that a conscientious objector status can extend beyond religious belief, but they denied conscientious objector status to individuals who say, I'm opposed to this specific war. And I think there's also a standard out there that says, look, you had to have demonstrated this belief, this conscientious objection, before you enlisted in this war, before for a long period of time. You can't have had a change of heart. So where does that leave individuals who go to Iraq and who see what's really happening on the ground without the filter of this corporate-run media, and they come back and they say this is wrong, and they can't go back? What happens to them? Under our U.S. military law, they don't qualify as conscientious objectors.
I see Michael Smith nodding in agreement with you that you have to have been a CO, a conscience objector, before you even went into war.
Which basically means that you never would have signed up.
Right, that's correct, of course.
So they're saying anybody who has ever signed up, you're just locked in. You have no right to grow as a human being. You have no right to expand your horizons, to see something and decide that this is going to impact your future actions. You lose that right. While we're remembering people like Lieutenant Aaron Watada and Augustin Aguayo, we also need to think about Kevin Benderman, who was released from Fort Lewis Military Corrections Facility on the 18th of August this summer. He served a year of a 15-month sentence because he refused to fight in Iraq. Jeremy Hinzman, he went to Canada, was denied asylum. We have Pablo Paredes, who was sentenced to 3 months hard labor for refusing to participate in the war. I think if people want to support, where in the National Lawyers Guild can they go?
We'll put up the National Lawyers Guild military task force on our website, and we will also put up Citizen Soldiers link, and they should go to either one of those organizations to get a referral.
We're joined now by attorney Peter Goldberger, who filed the habeas corpus petition for Agustina Gallo. Peter, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
On Law and Disorder, we've been following the conscientious objectors that have arisen in response to this war. Can you tell us a little bit about Agustina Gallo?
Well, Agustina Gallo is a medic in the U.S. Army who is facing a court-martial this week in Germany for refusing to go back to Iraq a second time. Now, he's not a political war resister. He's a conscientious objector. Agustina Gallo applied for a discharge from the Army because he joined voluntarily thinking that he could participate without violating his deepest religious and moral principles. But like so many young people, his views changed and based on his experiences and what he saw, and he realized that he had made a terrible mistake and he could not continue and could not participate. U.S. law recognizes the military's own regulations, recognizes that this does happen to some people, and when it does, they're entitled to apply for a discharge and receive an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector.
What happened? Did he get to Iraq?
He applied soon before being deployed to Iraq the first time.
He's in Germany, I guess. Is that right, when he applies?
I think that's right, if I remember right. Yes, he was already in Germany. That's where he's been mainly stationed. And his application hadn't been ruled on at that time. Merely filing the application doesn't give you an exemption from when you're already in the military, from following orders and continuing to be deployed. They do accommodate you. They ask to the extent they can, and they're usually pretty good about this. While your application is pending, they try to give you duties which least conflict with what you say your new beliefs are. He went to Iraq intending to be a medic and hoping to have his hearing and be discharged. And he actually had an interview and a hearing and was interviewed by another officer and by a chaplain. And the fellow they assigned to interview him into Crete, he had his hearing into Crete, found him to be sincere and recommended that he ought to be discharged. But that has to go up a long, winding chain of command, and the higher up it got in the process, the more the people that never met him and didn't know him said, oh, well, maybe he's trying to get out of it for this reason or for that reason. And in the end, they turned him down for what we say is no good reason at all.
And then what happened next?
Well, so at that point, you do have a right to seek a judicial review on habeas corpus. At least so far, you can use habeas corpus in federal court. If you're stationed overseas, you file that in Washington, D.C. That's what I did.
Explain for our listeners without a legal background what that means.
Sure. It's a petition to the court asking to be released from any form of custody that the government may have you in. And ironically and accurately, being enlisted in the military is viewed as a kind of custody, like being in prison or in a mental hospital or
or both.
or anything else. That's right. Because you can't leave voluntarily. And so just as a prisoner challenging the legality of a conviction can use habeas corpus, just as detainees in overseas detention facilities ought to be able to use habeas corpus, a member of the military who's asked to be discharged, been denied a discharge, can also ask a civilian court to look at the denial under the guise of habeas corpus. Now, the scope of scrutiny or review that the federal judge can give to the military decision is quite limited. And the federal judge in Washington, D.C., found that there was some basis, not necessarily a good basis, but some basis for turning him down and denied the petition.
Based on some basis.
Yes, and that's the standard. The standard is very poor. The standard of review is very limited in federal courts.
It's like sort of any facially valid reason they give, and you can't go behind it, really, essentially.
Well, any facially valid reason for which there is a fact in the record.
Right.
That's right. Well, that's the point at which it starts getting interesting and exciting, his story.
Let me just ask you, that case went to the Court of Appeals also, right?
Right. But that's getting a little bit ahead, because what happened was when he, just about the time that the federal judge turned him down at the lower level, they subjected him to one of these stop-loss orders. By this time, the case has been dragging along so long, he's almost ready to be discharged. But like so many people who've been assigned to go to Iraq, they extend his date with a stop-loss order.
Wow, how interesting, huh?
And ordered him to go back to Iraq a second time. He was, you know, he'd been done with Iraq and had gone to Germany. I'm a little bit jumping around here, but I should mention that while he was in Iraq, supposedly being given duties that least conflict with his views, he was ordered to take some patrol and guard duty.
Is that typical for an Army medic?
In a war zone, apparently it is. He got an award even while this was going on for his performance as a medic. He wasn't slacking. He went out on guard duty in Iraq, decided what he could do is he could carry his rifle, but he wouldn't load it. He wouldn't put any bullets in so that he wouldn't put himself in a position where he'd have to hurt another person. So actually put himself in greater jeopardy for his beliefs.
That's astonishing.
It was to me.
It certainly is.
So they ordered him to go a second time. He said, I wouldn't go. This time he no longer, you know, he doesn't have protection against going again. The judges just turned him down. And he disappeared from his barracks for a day when on the day his group was supposed to go back. Came back the next day, turned himself into military police, classic civil disobedience kind of tactic, surrendered himself voluntarily to be arrested. And the MP said, we can't arrest you. We don't have any charges pending against you. Go home. So they sent him back to his barracks, and next thing you know, there's six guys with guns telling him, we're taking you and putting you on an airplane and sending you back to Iraq. He said, I need to get my gear, went back into his bedroom and disappeared out the back window. And that's what he's charged with now in this court-martial, is going AWOL for about a month.
What, did he turn himself back in?
He voluntarily turned himself in.
In California?
At a church in California, and then went to a military base in California. How he got out of Europe and back to the United States and in California is not publicly known at this point. But he turned himself in voluntarily again, hoping that they would recognize him and discharge him, perhaps not as a conscientious objector this time, but at least for some reason. And they do that sometimes to people who've gone AWOL, but not in his case. Instead, they took him into custody, sent him back to Germany, and charged him not only with going AWOL, but with deserting.
Yeah, which is pretty serious, right?
Very serious.
Desertion is a very serious crime. Desertion means either leaving permanently with no intent to return, which the facts wouldn't seem to hold up in his case, or leaving for the purpose of avoiding hazardous duty.
Is there a death penalty associated?
That's what he's charged with. Theoretically, it's a death penalty
case. That's what I thought. Yeah, desertion is a death penalty case.
Yes.
In so-called time of war, which they treat this as.
Right.
When was the last time someone was executed for desertion?
I think that was Second World War, yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's not so long ago.
Well, yeah, the way this country's going, maybe they'll revive it.
Yeah. Well, in any event, they're not. The military prosecutor is threatening him at most with a 7-year sentence. I don't want to over-dramatize it, but that's bad enough. While he was away and before he had turned himself in, that was the time we needed to appeal. And Michael asked me about the appeal. We did appeal because we thought the judges turning him down really did have no basis. We appealed to the District of Columbia Federal Appeals Court. At our request, they put the case on a fast track. We filed briefs, and I argued it around Thanksgiving time in the Court of Appeals. And we drew, ironically, the same very conservative panel that just decided the Guantanamo habeas corpus.
It was Randolph and Santel you had on
That's
the bench, right?
Right? That's right.
And they are the ones who, you know, 2-1, Randolph and Santel in the majority, decided that people outside the United States, non-citizens, had no right to habeas.
At all. That's
at all,
right.
Period.
Yeah. So now, they didn't say that in Augie's case, but they did impose an even stricter limited review than the precedents would seem to call for. I mean, our argument was that under the precedents in that court for similar cases, he was entitled to win, and I do believe this very strongly. Guess when those precedents were set?
1965.
From 1965 to 1974, there were dozens of similar cases during the Vietnam War, and the judges then, as the war got less popular, the judges got more generous in interpreting this standard for judicial review. And so the many precedents were set during that time that look to a lawyer today to be pretty favorable.
The real answer is, you know, what we figured out in the Guantanamo cases, Peter, is that Randolph doesn't care about being reversed. You know, he was reversed in the initial Guantanamo cases in the Razul case.
Yeah.
In this recent case, it was clear from Razul that the court's pretty clear they're going to hold there's a constitutional right to habeas. But he just didn't care. Yeah. And that's what I've heard, that he just doesn't care.
Well, tell us the standard that, as you understand it, and then the standard that the court imposed.
Well, the standard on paper is, as Michael summarized it before, if there's any facts in the record, and the record means the record that was made in the Army appeal process, the Army hearing and appeal process. You don't get a new hearing. The court reviews only what the Army's investigation revealed. If there's any factual basis for the reasons that they in the military gave for turning him down, and those reasons are legally valid reasons, then the federal civilian court should uphold the decision. In the precedent set in the late 60s and early 70s, the courts were willing to say that the reasons were not good reasons or that the facts cited didn't really support those reasons more freely than had been the case in when these cases first started bubbling up in the 50s and early 60s, the Korean War and the Between the War cases, or than the courts have in the last couple of years. So I almost feel that Judge Randolph and Judge Sentelle are daring us to take this to the Supreme Court to see if the Supreme Court will endorse the more generous reading of the habeas corpus power in conscientious objector cases that was said in Vietnam, or the narrow and unsympathetic reading that this and a small number of other similar cases have set in the last couple of years in Iraq War cases.
So is the Supreme Court your next stop? You hope?
Well, we have a right to seek rehearing. There are 10 judges, I think, on the District of Columbia Court, and we can ask all 10 of them to look at the decision of these three, and I think that's most likely the thing we'll do next. Gives us a chance to look at the case from one more time before taking it to the Supreme Court, and then we have to think about, will we take it to the Supreme Court? Michael's the expert on taking cases like this to the Supreme Court.
Well, we'll see, Peter. I mean, you know, we're going up, obviously, under cases.
I know.
But, in this case, who knows? It may be the time.
You know, some people have said, tongue-in-cheek, the Supreme Court's the most liberal appeals court in the country these days.
Yeah, but it may not be getting any better.
But, I think it may be. I mean, we've been getting, look what's happened in the cases.
Well,
you know?
The Supreme Court does appear to be more willing to apply law to these cases.
Right. At least five of the judges.
Than prejudice. Yeah.
Five of the judges today, and which is a slim margin, but it's still five.
Yeah. Stevens, hang on. Mm-hmm. For those listeners who've just tuned in, we've been talking to attorney Peter Goldberger, who is the pro bono attorney for Augustine Aguayo. Peter, what are your last thoughts if you want to sum up this whole situation got yourself involved in?
Yeah, the most recent development in Augie's case is one that I want to mention because it's rather exciting. Did you know the Mexican government just announced their formal support for him? The Mexican legislature passed a resolution condemning his court-martial trial. They're sending a diplomatic observer because Augie was born in Mexico, moved to Los Angeles. He's become an American citizen, but Mexico still views him as a native son and I believe as a dual citizen.
So that's fantastic.
That's really amazing.
So as they made a statement, the Mexican Congress made a statement against the war in Iraq and in support of Augustine Aguayo and are sending a consular representative to his court-martial.
Yeah, we're sent. Amnesty International has sent representatives to his court-martial as well in Germany. Peter Goldberger, thank you so much. We offer you our best support, and hopefully we'll have you on to congratulate you very soon.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, you have our great admiration.
Yes, Peter, it's really a great
work.
Case. Congratulations.
Well, thanks for having me. You do wonderful work.
conscientious objector status, you know, has been a long tradition in American history, more in the statement than in the actual giving it to people. But the big cases came, as Peter said, in 1965 to 70 during the Vietnam War. And the first mother of all cases, really, is Seeger versus the United States. And that's actually Pete Seeger, who refused to go to Vietnam, refused to go into the draft, rather, on the conscientious objector status. He went up saying, I don't believe in a supreme being, and that was the first case that held that you don't have to believe in a supreme being to be a conscientious objector, and it's actually Pete Seeger who brought that case to the court.
We now go to a speech by Helga Aguayo, Agustin Aguayo's wife. We'll also hear from one of his twin daughters.
Thank you, everyone, for being here and for showing your support to this important cause. And thank you for Augustine's family for coming out. This is the first time they are all here together in support of him, his parents, aunts, uncles, and I can't thank them enough. I am the wife of Agustin Aguayo, conscientious objector and war resister. I don't know how many of you know this story, but on September 1st, he got orders to deploy and refused to deploy and was told by his second lieutenant not to go to the deployment because they didn't want a domino effect. My husband stayed home and waited for them to come for him and then decided to go because we were fearful that they would take him by force, and that is what, in fact, what happened. Came to the apartment looking for him. The next day, my husband turned himself in to the MP station, only to find out that he would not be court-martialed, but that he would be taken by force to Iraq in shackles, handcuffs, and taken, lifted onto the plane if need be. When he saw the opportunity, he escaped, got out the back window of our apartment. And what I want people to know is that that was not an act of cowardice. It was an act of bravery. It would have been much easier for him to go to Iraq. He went to Iraq once before, and for 2004, 2005, as a conscientious objector. And when he went there, he refused to load his gun. My husband is not a coward. While there, he did guard duty, patrols, without ammunition, and the unit knew about it and said, if he wishes to die, if he has a death wish, so be it. They still put him on guard duty, and they still sent him out on patrols. My husband, when he went to Iraq the first time, thought that because he had followed all the rules and was doing what was required of him as a conscientious objector, filling out the application, doing all the interviews, that he would be found to be a conscientious objector, but he was not. 6 months into his deployment, he was denied, and his status was taken away. And he continued to work and serve. But after being in Iraq, he knew that when he went, he would not kill. But after being there, he knew he could never go back and support that. And so on September 1st, he refused to go. And I don't know how many of you saw that, but he held a press conference on September 26th in Los Angeles. And then with the support of wonderful, lovely people, peace lovers such as ourselves, he turned himself in Barstow, Fort Irwin. And the unit was so angry with him and so outraged with his actions that they actually had the same two sergeants that lost him come and get him, and they took him back to Mannheim. He's currently in pretrial confinement, and he's facing 7 years. He's a good person. He doesn't deserve this. And I can't thank you enough for supporting us and for allowing me to share our story and for just holding our hands when we need to be, when you do, and giving us a hug because, you know, this is really hard for us. One of my daughters has prepared something to say on behalf of both of my daughters, and she'd like to read it. Her name is Raquel.
We are really proud of our dad. He taught us to stand up for what we believe in. so we support him even though this has been really hard. I wish our dad was home. We think this is unfair and we want people to know that our father is such a good person and he does not deserve this. We are a strong family and we are going through this together. Our father is not the only one suffering. We all are. But he is standing up for what he believes in and we believe in him. We don't care that people think he's a coward because we know he is not. He is our hero, and we will be together soon. For now, we really miss him, and your support has made this hard time easier, and we just wanted to thank you.
That was Helga Aguayo, wife of conscientious objector Augustine Aguayo.
We want to just update listeners on the Augustine Aguayo situation. Although faced with a maximum of 7 years in prison, Augustine was sentenced to 8 months in the brig for following his conscience and refusing to participate in the illegal war in Iraq.